The information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice or treatment. If you're concerned about your health in any way, we encourage you to consult your GP.
People don't like talking about it, but incontinence can affect anyone. You may have a friend or relative who lives with it every day, or maybe you're worried about your own incontinence. Incontinence Talks is here to make us all feel more confident about continence, hosted by former Olympian rower and Coloplast ambassador Pete Reed. Today, Pete chats to Michelle Hogan-Trix and Emma Russell about the different treatment options available for people suffering with retention and constipation.
We've said a lot in this series as well that everybody's different. So yeah. There's a massive spectrum from somebody who's had a catastrophic spinal cord injury, someone that might have had a big operation after a cancer diagnosis, MS, cauda equina, and the other end of the spectrum, people that need to change the way they sit on the loo and change their diet. And nobody likes to feel like a burden. So everyone would probably want to assume that they're okay. Can we myth bust a bit to make sure people feel seen and validated, especially if they're a bit scared and nervous? Because we're about to go into seeking help from the GP, don't suffer in silence, and also the options available, because unique cases, there are ways to help have a healthier, more confident life where, and I've had a spinal cord injury, I haven't once had a spill, like a leak, a poo leak, which is great, but that's purely down to what I use and what my daily routine is. It'll happen one day and I'm not looking forward to it, but I'm one of the lucky ones where there's something clearly wrong, so I got all the education I needed early in the process. And especially with maybe a degenerative condition like MS, it might happen a little bit slowly. The person that it's happening to might be scared that this is going in a direction. They might not want to seek help early enough. Can you reassure people and talk through what some of the options are for both bowel and bladder, actually?
So, yeah, I mean, it really does depend on the condition. It depends on what you're diagnosed with. But, you know, for emptying your bladder, there are intermittent catheters. There are indwelling catheters, suprapubic catheters, which go through the tummy. But we obviously know that ISC is the gold standard for bladder drainage. So something that we're taught as nurses and healthcare professionals. So ideally, that's the best way, because hopefully it will reduce your risk of UTIs than rather having an indwelling in. There are other options, but as I said, it really does depend on the condition and the patient. And what's going to suit their lifestyle, because I think you've really got to fit that management option in with their life. It's got to fit with them. It's got to fit their lifestyle, their quality.
And what I would add is absolutely that, Emma, but I would just urge people, if you are having issues, in particular if you have another condition as well, in particular if it's a neurological condition or a spinal issue, please, please just go and seek help. If you think it's because you've had a baby, or you think it's because you're, you know, getting a bit older and your prostate's enlarged a wee bit, or don't self-diagnose with this. Please just go and speak to somebody about it, because it could be, you know, we just want to get to a place where we're helping people regain control of all of this. And it makes me really sad when I speak to people who have been experiencing issues for 5-6 years and really quite significant issues. And actually, myself or Emma will think, my goodness, there's actually a really simple solution here, and you've been suffering for all that time. And then retrospectively, they'll say, oh my God, I wish I went, you know, if I had a pound for the amount of people that said,
finding the right person as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's finding the right person, pursuing, if you don't feel that it's being managed correctly at primary care level, pursuing, asking to speak to a specialist in, you know, a specialist continence service, for example. Pete, you're, you know, lucky that you had such a great journey with your rehabilitation and your bladder and bowel included in that. But I'd just like to add as well that for spinal cord injury, actually only the latest figures show that only 20% of patients get to a specialist spinal cord injury unit. Only
what?
20%.
What
yeah,
do,
it used to be
do?
33%.
They go
it's
home?
Now 20. They might go to a rehab service that's not neuro specialist. So perhaps they won't quite understand the nuances as well as a specialist service. And I just want to say there's many that are excellent as well. Just want to caveat that. But, you know, some might just go home. You're right. Some might go to community physio, for example, who we've not quite picked up that they've got bladder and bowel dysfunction. So, yeah, people are kind of going to lots of other places apart from expert services.
And their spinal cord injuries are all a bit different. So where they are on the spine, how bad the injuries are, what they're presenting with. But so the listeners have a bit of context. There are 11 specialist spinal units in the UK dotted around. Yeah. They're always stretched for beds.
Always.
What I found was it's not so much a physio place. It's more of an education centre. I went there to really learn from the spinal cord injury nurses on the key things were bladders, bowel, skin care, sexual function, and reintegrating back to home. They're sort of getting you ready for being at home and being independent. So the aim is you learn as much as you can so you don't go back there quickly or don't end up in hospital again. And I had really good experiences, especially with bowel care with the nurses there, because it was their bread and butter. It was just normal. They could teach me, show me. That wasn't quite the case in secondary care in the initial hospital where they're doing everything and juggling everything.
And it's not their speciality.
No, it's not. So there's no blame or finger pointing there at all. I know I got really lucky.
That must have been music to your ears.
Yes, it's music to my ears.
Right?
Okay, I love those happy stories.
It was a happy story despite what was going on.
Yeah.
There's something I've been meaning to ask you, Emma. So you mentioned intermittent self-catheterization, you mentioned indwelling catheters, and you mentioned suprapubic, which we've covered throughout the podcast, but we can cover in this episode as well. But when I was researching for this episode, I came across a word that I hadn't seen before. I'm going to read it now and butcher the pronunciation, but Mitrofanov?
Mitrofanov.
So what is that?
That is the easiest way to describe it is a hole basically that goes into the bladder.
How is that different from suprapubic then?
Because it can be, you can put the catheters in and out.
Oh, okay.
So rather than the catheter sitting there all the time, balloon in the bladder, draining into a bag, you can actually use intermittent catheters into it.
So while I've got you on the subject, and I know we've gone through this a little bit before, but please, can you explain the mechanics for anyone that doesn't catheterize or need to, but maybe they're interested or maybe they're a patient advocate, those four different processes. So where are you putting the catheter? I'll leave that explanation to you if I can.
Okay, so when you're doing intermittent catheterization, that is self-intermittent catheterization, you're putting the thin hollow tube into your bladder via your urethra, which is male or female, will... And then you're passing it through up to the bladder and emptying the bladder that way. So you're doing that intermittently as and when you need to, depending on the regime. Some people only have to do it once or twice a day. Some people have to do it 3-4 times a day, and some people up to 6 times a day. Then you've got the indwelling catheter, which is a catheter that, again, it's a hollow tube, has a balloon at the end, which gets inflated once it's inserted into the bladder, and you can either have it on continually draining, so you have a leg bag on your leg, or you can have it on a valve, depending on your condition. So that allows you to be able to sort of almost feel like you can actually go for a wee over a toilet without having a bag attached to your leg. And you can have that exactly the same with the suprapubic, except it goes directly into your tummy, into your bladder. Same. You can have it on a bag or a valve. The Mitrofanov or urinary diversion type operations are really sort of the end of their journey, really, when all else has failed or there's nothing they can do to obviously help, but they will have to just empty their bladder through that. Or they can have a urostomy, which is the diversion, which is when they have a little stoma.
But so the people that don't do any of this, this will sound like, it will sound scary to them. So to reassure, I guess, people or people that do use these devices to pee, I use these devices, self-catheterized, but 5 times a day or whatever it ends up being. I make sure I watch the clock to see when I need to go because I can't feel it. And it's perfectly, 5 times a day for the last 5 years, you can do the maths. I've done it a lot, and I just wheel up to a loo and catheterize and pee It doesn't take much longer than before. It's obviously a bit different, but I, apart from UTIs, I don't have a problem with the process of peeing. It feels it's normal now.
But how long did it take you to get that normal process? How long in your journey did it get? Did that become your normal?
Okay. So actually very quickly, but then this is part of me saying that I feel lucky because I had a spinal cord injury. So in the course of 20 minutes, you go from being able-bodied to not being able to walk. So my life was this explosion of everything going wrong and losing a lot of things. Bladder function was one of those things. So I had an indwelling catheter. So actually, when I was being taught by very, very good urology nurses about the process of self-catheterization, I know that's not normal for everybody, but it was a relief for me because it was part of claiming back my independence. And so right from the start, it's not normal pushing a pipe up your
pee hole. But it's finding your new normal though.
Yeah. So it's finding your new normal. And I found that quite quickly because of all the other things going on.
And gaining, as you just said, you know, it's something that actually when you are going through such a catastrophic event, gaining control of your bladder and bowel function is wonderful. It's starting to give you control back. But what I wanted to ask is, so for many people, you know, they might come into clinic, they might be taught how to intermittently catheterize in half an hour, depending on the clinic, and then off they pop. Whereas you had lots of support, I suspect, within the unit.
And support, and the conversation, wee and poo wasn't taboo.
Wee and poo wasn't taboo. I like that.
Yeah,
you've got a new hashtag there.
So it would be normal topic of conversation in the bays on the spinal ward because everyone would be having their bowel routines at the same time.
Yeah, there's no escaping it.
So everyone would say, did it go all right this morning? What are you learning?
And brilliant.
So the big difference is if someone's going in to see their GP and walking out with news of you might need self-catheterize, these are the options, go to the chemist, then they are losing something and getting a downgrade.
Yeah.
That in their perception.
Yeah.
Where when I was learning about self-catheterization, I was getting an upgrade because it was going from indwelling in hospital bed, paralyzed, not moving, to okay, you can get your life back.
Gaining control.
In this very personal area.
And that's really interesting. Again, some of the research that I've done, when we look at on the whole, and obviously there's outliers, but when you look at the spinal injured group, that's exactly it, right? You have your injury for many people, and this is what I'm left with, and I have to somehow pick up the pieces, get on, learn all of this new thing, which is mind-blowing, devastating, difficult, but you are where you are. Whereas when you look at some degenerative conditions, whatever that is, the research I've done is with MS, it's often for some people it's exactly what you've said. You're getting a downgrade. It's admitting that things are getting, you know, worse. But I would say to anyone listening, please don't look at it like that. You know, going and seeking help, getting the right management is you gaining control back. It's you gaining control of your condition. It's you saying, actually, I am going to go out with my friends tonight. I am going to go to Oxford Street shopping instead of a shopping mall because there might be less toilets. You know, people tend to start to toilet map, we call it. They'll only go where they know there's toilets.
Yeah, you've got a database going on.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've downloaded the app and everything.
Yeah. Download the app, which is great, by the way.
Yeah, I think there's a Toilet Finder app. There's a Wheelmate app. I can't remember the names off the top of my head, but if you go to your Play Store or Google Store, I'm sure there's different toilet finding apps and they can really help people when they're trying to travel.
You know, just to think by getting the right treatment, you're going to gain control back.
Yeah, that's so true. So it's an upgrade.
Not
it's an upgrade for them as well.
Yeah,
like it's
absolutely.
A reclaiming of identity. And
I love that. It's an upgrade.
Yeah, it is an upgrade.
Mm. I mean, this, you know, simple things like this, these can regain someone's quality of life. You know, someone can actually get a good night's sleep and be able to function the next day. You know, continence during the day can be achieved. And that's where good teaching and good support and, you know, that advocacy from the nursing team or from whatever healthcare professional they seek help from is really, really imperative. That's patient-centered. You're looking at the patient, what's important to them, and finding the right fit for them, finding the right treatment.
Is that the same, Michelle, with bowel care? So the options, as far as I'm concerned, I think it's irrigation or a stoma, but I don't know. So I use an irrigation system and there's a lot of plumbing. It works for me. It's not ideal. It's not like pre-injury of just nipping to the loo, sitting down, easy, swift, clean. But this new process gives me independence, gives me confidence. I'm cleaner than most people. I know I am because there's, well, I won't go into mechanics too much, but you're all washed out. So I have confidence going about my day.
Yeah.
The big problem for me is making sure that I know where I'm going to have a private loo place.
Yeah, I mean...
But what are the options? Sorry.
Yes, I think with both, actually, bladder and bowel, as you say, look, it's... Would you rather be able to pop along to a toilet, have a pee, have a poo, without needing to use devices to help? Yes, I'm sure most people would prefer that. But I think the thing is, as Emma has said, it's the right treatment, whether it is bladder or bowel, for you. And that, you know, for some people that might be pads, for some people that might be medication, for some people that might be intermittently catheterizing. For some people it might be botulinum toxin, which you may know one of the brands, and there are many others, as Botox. And it's the same for bowel, really. So as I can't really stress enough, if you're having any sort of accidents or, you know, real constipation or anything like that, please, please just go and speak to your doctor about it, or you know, your GP practice. And if you don't feel that you're getting that right treatment, then do pursue to try and speak to a specialist. So in regard to bowel, it's maybe easy to describe. We have something called a treatment pyramid. I don't know if you've seen it before or not, but essentially it's a piece of work that was done by some international clinicians. And it has three kind of rungs on it. And the bottom rung, so the bottom part of the triangle, if you imagine a triangle, is wider at the bottom and then it's smaller at the top. So the bottom rung of that triangle is very much this kind of general lifestyle advice that we spoke about earlier, exercise, whatever that is. For many people, that's not running. So for example, for you, Pete, your exercise might look quite different to me or a wheelchair user who's not an Olympiad. it's whatever that looks like for you know, each person, and understanding, you know, really good, simple advice is often the answer for many people. However, what we know is people get stuck there. So once you start to need to use over-the-counter medication, so Senacot is an example that many people might know, or Lactulose, or...
And they're laxatives.
These are all laxatives that you can pop along to one of your local chemist and you can buy. Once you start to use these kind of things and it's not, you know, it's still not quite right for you, you really need to be sort of raising this. And a good friend and one of our colleagues always says, to then review. So if you have put yourself on more than two of these, or a clinician has, you know, we need to sort of rewind and start again. Then there are the kind of medications that you might use. People might know them as suppositories. Some of these you can buy over the counter, or little microlet enemas. So these are the small little enemas that you would stick in your bottom and squeeze something out. Or there's larger ones. These are sort of all on that bottom rung, but these are things that generally a clinician might advise you to use.
Can you explain what suppositories do? Because I, as far as I'm aware, they sort of stimulate the rectum.
So that's an example of one. There's various different suppositories that do various different things, but the one that we would start with usually is this thing of stimulation. So another thing that, before you get to that level, what if you do speak to a clinician, what they might ask you to do is just sort of stimulate around your bottom area. And you might what you naturally see actually with children, with babies, when they're kind of, if you look at babies who want to have a poo, they'll get themselves into the right position. They'll sort of do that crouching thing and they'll touch around their bottom. And then we kind of say, oh, don't do that. That's dirty. Again, another negative. It's actually an inherent thing. What I mean is, when babies do that, getting into the right position, toddlers, I should say, and touching around their bottom, that is an inherent thing that we have. telling us that if you actually touch around the area, it does create stimulation. I think you, did you talk about peristalsis?
We did. So what's the process? Thank you. That's what process is that touching or a suppository is stimulating?
Yeah, so that will stimulate a contraction. So for anyone who wants to rewind and remind themselves of GCSE biology or O-level biology, depending on your age, we learn about peristalsis, which to keep it not very technical, is when your gut needs to evacuate. Basically, the way you get your stool around and out of your system is something called peristalsis, kind of doing this to get around the plumbing system and
muscles
out.
Munching the muscles squeezing, moving.
Muscles munching. Muscles munching the food a lot.
And then it comes out.
Okay. Exactly. So for some people, that's not working as effectively as it should. And in particular, neurological patients, actually. But not only that. So if you touch around that area, you create those stimulations. And a suppository, glycerin is an example, will do exactly that. So you'd pop it in and you need to... Actually, one thing people don't realize is they just pop them in, but you do need to make sure it's touching against the wall of your rectum. Otherwise, it's just going to sit there and not
do nothing.
Do anything. But it's sugar, basically. Glycerin is sugar, and it just causes your rectum to stimulate. And that bottom bit of your plumbing, your rectum, is like a storage facility. So what should happen with a usual bowel is you should really, keeping it simple again, you should only really get stool collecting in there as you want to. You know, we would go to the toilet and empty our rectum, and then it should be nice and clear. It should be empty. We've talked a lot about incomplete bladder emptying, but actually it's the same for bowels. They may not always completely empty, and then you might get a spasm because your bowels might not be working. They might not be behaving as they should be. And then if you've got stool in your rectum, you might have an accident. So that's one of the examples of why people have accidents.
You were talking about the pyramid.
So
we're climbing up this pyramid.
So that's kind of that bottom rung. And really, almost the bottom rung is almost split in two. You've got the very simple piece, and then you get into these slightly more complicated medications like the suppositories and
enemas.
Help me out. Enemas. Thank you, Emma. Mind went blank there. Which really, you know, I would say if you're self-prescribing that stuff, please go and speak to somebody. Just get some advice. Then you've got the middle rung of the pyramid. And this is where we go into things like transanal irrigation, which we talked very briefly about earlier. And as you've just sort of talked about, it's an irrigation system that there are various different ones.
I use Peristeen, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't mind mentioning it. It's an irrigation system by Coloplast.
Yeah, Peristeen is one of ours, and we're very proud to have lots of accreditation with NICE for Peristeen. So what will happen is you essentially just fill up the base of it, if we can call
with water,
it that.
Yeah,
with water,
water
from
yeah.
the tap. It's nice and tepid. It's got a nice little indicator to tell you it's the right temperature, which is great for people, again, who might have spinal injury, who may not feel. So you've got a nice little temperature there. And then you have a catheter, which is disposable. You put that in your rectum when you're sitting over the toilet. There's two different ways. You can either have a balloon on it, so you don't have to hold it yourself, or you can have one with a cone that you do have to hold. It does sound a little bit complicated, but once you've got used to it, you know, you will say yourself, Pete, it's with the right support, which you absolutely should have. These are things that you need to get prescribed by clinicians. And essentially what that does is it irrigates your bowel. It helps with that stimulation all the way up to your transverse colon, not wanting to get too technical with this. But like you just said, it gives you confidence that if you are someone with constipation, if you are someone who's having these strange spasms and accidents, actually transanal irrigation will clear you out, you know, quite significantly. So you know that you can go about your business for the day. For some people, it's a whole day. For some people, it might be half a day. For some people, it's 2 days, 3 days. You get to know your bowels, right? But it just gives you confidence that actually, I know, as you said, I'm cleaner than most people. That you know that you're not going to have, or you're going to significantly reduce the amount of accidents that you may have, or that might be for some people just very severe constipation, which also is incredibly uncomfortable and not very nice.
So I'm an athlete. So yes. It means I'm really competitive, or was an athlete. I'm desperate to know what the top of this pyramid is, because yeah. that's where I'm yeah. at the level that you've just described.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the tippy top?
So as I kind of said, as you're on the base, that's where most people should be. And then the kind of transanal irrigation is in the middle. And that's really the end of what we would call conservative management. So it's a great option for people, anyone who's kind of needing to do a bit of stimulation, whatever that stimulation might be, anyone who feels they're not completely empty in them, that they're, you know, their bowels, they're having accidents, things like that. It's something that you can go and have a discussion with your healthcare professional about. The top is where we start to look at surgical intervention. So most of the top, and we'll keep it simple, really, most people will have heard of an a stoma. So this is where we get into the colostomy bag part of the bowel treatment pyramid. There are various other things in there as well, but they're a little bit more technical. And so that's really that kind of tiny pointy bit. So the point is, lots of points here. That's kind of the least amount of people should be up there. And what you don't want is someone going from, oh, well, I've tried lifestyle advice and it's really, really not working for me. I've tried a couple of suppositories. It's not really working, straight to stoma. You know, you want to make sure you've got the right person on the right treatment plan at the right time. Technically, you don't always have to start at the bottom and work your way up. So, for example, if you had a very high-level injury, somebody who couldn't, unfortunately, you know, couldn't move their arms or their legs, you may opt for someone like that. If they don't have carers and they don't have loved ones who can appropriately manage their bowels in another way, you may opt, and this is going to be a small group, to go straight to stoma. For some spinal injured patients, you may also opt very quickly to go straight to transanal irrigation. So you don't always have to start from the bottom.
So Emma, with the bladder emptying options that are available, I'm wondering what's appropriate, what the pros and cons of each, because I remember having an indwelling catheter very early on, so having my spinal stroke, losing use of my legs and of my bladder, having that surgical procedure and lying in bed with a big pipe coming out into a bag, and that didn't last very long. And I remember the transition from indwelling to self-catheterization. What are the pros and cons? When should they be used and when shouldn't they be used?
So it sounds like you were really lucky, actually, that you got transitioned from an indwelling to ISC quite quickly. But some people, unfortunately, get left with an indwelling for long periods of time.
What's the problem
with
that?
Which is not ideal, because for every day that the catheter is in, they're increasing the risk of having a catheter-associated urinary tract infection, which obviously people are aware that UTIs can really knock you back. It can really make you feel very unwell. You can have issues with the catheters blocking. So there's a lot of sort of risks when the catheter is in there.
Damage to the urethra.
Skin damage if it's not attached properly.
So if people are discharged from hospital with an indwelling catheter, am I paraphrasing, but that's not ideal?
It's not ideal. The gold standard is intermittent self-catheterization. That's what we would aim for, is that anybody that can't actually empty their bladder should be able to do ISC. But we know that that's not going to suit everybody. And that, you know, if people do need an indwelling catheter, then that's what they're going to have. A suprapubic is probably going to be one of the better ones. But still, it has its risks. It's an infection risk. At the end of the day, it's an operation. There are risks of it being inserted, so it shouldn't be taken lightly, and that's why the options should be given.
So why is, we've mentioned it a couple of times, why is ISC the gold standard?
So ISC is the gold standard for bladder drainage because it's not keeping the catheter in there all the time. So it's reducing the risk of UTIs in that aspect. It's giving that patient the quality of life and the confidence and their life back, basically. They're able to do it themselves and keep their condition in control.
Both of you, you're nurses, so you've done this before. Urology nurses, you've catheterized people.
Many a time.
And normal every time? Like, what? I don't even know what normal is. I've been catheterized, by the way, by nurses, so I know what it's like. But how many have you done? More than 10?
I mean, there's that greeting card, isn't there? I've seen more willies than a prostitute type okay. thing. Being a urology nurse,
more than 1,000.
I'd say.
Wow.
24 years.
I mean, I was a recovery sister for 7 years. Everyone kind of turns up, throws all the covers off, and you know.
I mean, then you get to a point, I think, where you. Where you have bladder and bowel problems and you do just think, oh, just let loose, just be open about it. Sometimes they are, especially when they come to healthcare professionals. And I had one chap who was coming for his catheter to be taken out.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was a certain rise.
Oh, go on.
It's something that you, as a healthcare professional, don't want to draw your eyes to.
So I'm going to jump in a little bit there. That might not. Sorry to. Well, you've raised it. Sorry.
Raised it. But, let's talk about it.
But that might not be a sexual thing, right? It's not a chap just thinking this is a.
Or it might have been.
This is
no.
a. I'm aroused in this.
I mean, it was the excitement of getting his catheter out, maybe.
No, but is there. This is a thing that they would be mortified and presumably not in any way aroused and just thinking, what on earth is going on here? What happened?
Well, it's happened a couple of times, unfortunately, okay. for the gents. But yeah, you just have to sort of you're nice about it. You don't make a song and dance about it because it's a natural thing. It's a natural thing for it to happen. You just have to carry on and keep doing what you're doing, and then just.
And then
let them go wee.
And then, do you say I'm just going to pop outside for 5 minutes?
Or like, I mean, get dressed.
You both said there's nothing that we haven't seen.
No.
Nothing that we haven't done.
No.
Maybe it's 10,000 times then that you've catheterized. And we haven't really.
I wish we did a tally chart now of how many lady and men bits we've seen.
I mean. I sometimes forget last week. How am I supposed to remember 24 years?
Can we talk about lady bits as well? Because I've got no experience of catheters with women. I've got loads on me, but
they're just as varied as the men's.
But more mechanically difficult because there's not a handle as that you've. I don't know.
Well, see, I think we would argue. That it's harder as
it's
women.
It's more difficult to find.
Men,
I mean, you generally can find yours as males. They're quite easy to find your urethra.
Wow.
Women have a little bit more of an issue. They can struggle to actually find the urethra. There's a lot. Every woman is different.
So hard to self-catheterize then.
It is hard. Yeah, it is difficult because it's sometimes locating the urethra that women find.
You can't
difficult.
See, like, at least with a penis.
Because we can't do that.
No.
Yeah.
For the purpose of the camera lifting, you can't lift up and see where you're going.
We try to get women to feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's the best way. Then you don't have to rely on mirrors and things like that.
But on the cleanliness, you need to be spotlessly clean for this process, male or female, because something's going up.
Something's going up?
Yeah.
So we have more layers, layers of lips or labias, whatever you want to call them. So we've been a bit more rootling around.
You do root around.
But then, there is a higher. There's a higher risk of not being able to find the hole.
Have you catheterized yourself?
I tried all the catheters
really?
when I was teaching. I tried all catheters that came on the market.
So I hadn't thought about this. Which was the best?
Well, Eve when I was there, but now it's.
So I don't want to delve too much into your medical history, but you're healthy. You've got healthy bladder, right? So healthy people can.
I've got a nurse's bladder. I've got quite a large one. But yeah, no, I'm completely healthy. But I would try. I try the catheters so I know how they
felt.
For research purposes.
Presumably,
for my
we wouldn't recommend healthy people using self-catheterization.
Not on a regular basis.
But it's not going to do any harm.
No.
And was it? So I can't feel anything when I do it. But can you?
So, yeah.
And how sore is it?
So when I tried with a larger size, when I tried with a 12, it was a bit uncomfortable. And then when I went down to a 10, it was more. It was fine.
I think it also depends on the product too.
Yeah, but also, you know, you feel a bit restless, but most people do after that first attempt. But otherwise, it was fine.
That's amazing that you tried them all,
and you get used to it.
Yeah, you get used to it. But I felt I had to be the best teacher of ISC for my patient. I felt I had to try because I would undoubtedly get asked, which one would you choose?
Sorry, you said 10. I thought you meant 10 different types of catheter.
No, the size 10. So so the catheters come in chariot sizes. So they come, most women would probably use 8, 10 or 12 size. And that's the, basically the thickness of the catheter.
My question, it's to both of you as we continue this last bit of sharing hope. It's about what should people do and where should they get their information? Because if they're a little bit worried, I think you could use a search engine on the internet, Dr. Google, and you could put some stuff in and it could take you all over the place with this subject area. So I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but with your experience, I think you'd know where can people, because we've talked about asking people to go and see their GP. We've also been saying that their GPs don't always know because it's a little bit taboo, the loo taboo thing. So how can people arm themselves with information? What sources are available? Where would you send people so that they can get appropriate information and ask the right questions to the right healthcare professionals?
Well, there are so many charities about, aren't there? There's the Bladder Health UK, Bladder and Bowel, the MS Trust. There's lots of different charities. ACP, yeah.
So charities is the third sector, I think.
Third sector.
But always a safe space to go to for information, yeah, as opposed to just Googling and coming across any old website.
I think whatever your condition is, try to find the charity or third sector, as we call them as well, that's responsible for that. So, for example, Spinal Injuries Association, Cordura Equina have CESCI, Cordura Equina, CESCI, Multiple Sclerosis Trust, there's also the MS Society, there's Prostate Cancer UK, there's, you know, all of these, you know you're going to get robust information. Of course, you
NHS can, as well.
NHS. Yep. We, Coloplast, have a wonderful, I'm biased, obviously, because Emma and I are very much involved within the education on our website. So it's absolutely wonderful.
So coloplast.co.uk, and then I've seen lots of infographics that have been useful to my education that I was shown by nurses 5 years ago. People can go there as well for all incontinence issues, but... are there incontinence charities if someone's just worried about this doesn't seem right or it wasn't like this a year ago?
Yes, there's Bladder and Bowel UK. If it's children, there's Eric is wonderful because so many children experience, in particular, constipation. It's not always, you don't always get the right information. So Eric's wonderful.
How do you spell Eric? Just
E-R-I-C.
Cool, great.
Nice and simple.
Nice and simple, yeah.
Yeah. Bladder and Bowel UK.
But it's knowing that you're not alone.
Yes.
And there is help out there and talking.
Thank you both of you for coming in to share your I'm sorry to say it again, decades of experience. And this is
thanks,
your
Pete.
Sorry, this is your world. So I'm saying it because we don't take it for granted. It's your world. So you speak about it very confidently and with extreme competence. You're the medical experts in this place, and I'm sure you've seen and done everything in your careers. We're really grateful that you've come in to speak to us, share that experience. You made it very, very easy to talk about, and I've said before, but a very difficult subject for me to talk about, so thank you for making it easy. And
thank you
that
for
knowledge.
Being so open. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for doing this because I think a lot of people will get a lot out of listening to.
Well, wouldn't it be nice if we started seeing those 5-year numbers come down, or started to see people progress through your pyramid a little bit quicker, or arm themselves, or feel a little less ashamed and accessing what they need to.
And I think that's the thing. And I know it's really easy for us to say this, but, you know, you said we talk about this a lot. We really, really do. And just to reassure people, I know it's difficult, but please, please, please do go and speak to your healthcare professionals, because we talk about it all the time, and we, you know, we'll have, I promise you, whatever you say, we will have heard it before. So please just, yeah, pop along, speak to somebody and pursue it if you don't feel like you're getting, you know, the right advice.
You might feel embarrassed, but you won't embarrass us.
Yeah, we won't be embarrassed.
Michelle, Emma, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
On our next episode, Pete is chatting to Coloplast Ambassador Jack and Hannah Gagan from Coloplast about continence care products. There are lots of amazing charities that can provide focused support depending on your particular needs, as well as lots of information at coloplast.co.uk. Thank you for listening to Incontinence Talks, and remember to consult your GP if you have any worries about your own continence.